Hello, August.
Hello. Pete, hello. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you too. And welcome to Ode to Resilience, our new podcast about
the Cyber Resilience Act, but maybe more than that too. Maybe the whole environment of cyber resilience.
Yeah, and but we're going to start with the Cyber Resilience Act, right? Which, what is the Cyber Resilience Act, August?
The Cyber Resilience Act is the premier product regulation for technology within the European Union. And it's a very exciting thing. But Pete, why would anyone listen to us when we're talking about the Cyber Resilience Act? We've just said it's important.
Yeah.
Who are we to talk about this?
Excellent question. So I'm Pete Favre. I am an electrical engineer currently working as a consultant specialized in the Cyber Resilience Act. So basically what that means is I spend my days talking to companies, to manufacturers, to help them understand what the Cyber Resilience Act is and how they can best be compliant with it. And that means all sorts of things. That means looking at how they can strategically address the Cyber Resilience Act from a high-level organizational view. So how do we deal with this as an organization in general? So how do we figure out what products that we have that are actually in scope? What is our compliance strategy? Do we do the testing in-house? Do we go external, et cetera, et cetera? So there's a whole bunch of things around that. But then I also provide a bunch of other services all the way down to helping product teams, so engineering teams, figure out how can we actually design these products in a secure way. And that's what I've filled the bulk of my time with, so consulting these industry clients. And then beyond that, I'm also very active in the so-called CRA implementation landscape. So that's more the governmental side of all of this, where through, for example, my participation in the European Commission's expert group, which is the group that advises the European Commission on how they need to deal with the Cyber Resilience Act, but also through involvement, through standardization, and through just attending a whole bunch of events and talking to a lot of people, try to make sure that I know all the ins and outs of this law. And then I use that knowledge both to help the CRA become a success, but then also help my clients figure out how to make the CRA a success for them. So that was kind of long. How about you, August? Who are you?
I do many of the same things that Pete does, but I do not have a background in cybersecurity. My name is August Bornique, and my background is in risk management. And then after that, I've been a lawyer, US-based, Silicon Valley-based lawyer for at least a decade working in technology and law. And I now am European-based. And as part of that, I've been working almost exclusively on the CRA for the past couple of years. And where I come in and what I've been doing is both working in the standardization effort, which is basically implementation of the Cyber Resilience Act, and also advising clients, nonprofits, open source groups regarding the CRA and what might be happening, and been working in many of the same rooms and same spaces that Pete has on this from basically the same perspective. And I also do work with manufacturers and other clients like that.
But maybe also, August, important to mention, because you kind of glossed over it, but I think it's a big deal, is where I say I was active in standardization, but that was as a normal participant. You have actually been a special rapporteur for some of the CRA standards, which means that you have been an editor or a project manager for these standards.
I've been working as a special rapporteur as part of a group. I am officially the special rapporteur on the SIEM systems vertical, which is the standard for SIEM systems.
What's a SIEM system?
A SIEM system is security system, network management system that specifically records security events and organizes them and then provides reports and things like that.
So it's like a thing that you use as an organization to monitor the security
It's a monitoring system. Security monitoring for network. But I've also been working with the other rapporteurs as part of the same group on VPNs, operating systems, network management systems, and network interfaces. So I've been pretty deeply involved in the implementation of the CRA when it comes to very specific technical areas. This has involved drafting standards, talking with industry about what they think should be in the standards, and talking to various experts about what they think should be in the standards, editing, that kind of thing. That's what the rapporteur process is. Lots of meetings, lots of interested parties, lots of stakeholders. The European Commission as well has given us a lot of directives about well, I won't say directives because that's a very special word, but a lot of information about what they think the standard should look like or how the law is going to work. So I won't call myself an insider, but I think I have quite a bit of knowledge about what the final kind of implementation of the CRA is going to look like.
I think you're absolutely an insider. And I think also all of this, these two introductions, if we want to keep it very simple, we can summarize it as, for both of us, the CRA is our life, right, at the moment.
Yeah, it is. We could differentiate ourselves a little bit. This isn't really true. I would say Pete's our sort of cybersecurity expert, very technical. Ask your technical questions to Pete. I'm more on the policy side. And that would be the sort of place where we maybe differ a bit. Obviously, we're very different people. Yeah, but those are our two sort of specialties.
And you're really coming from that legal side, right? So I actually also consider myself to be fairly involved in the policy aspect of this, but from a very technical perspective.
Exactly, you are.
It's often very interesting. Like, the reason I like talking to you is because you bring these considerations about the same text that we've both been reading back and forth many times, but you bring them from a different angle, and that brings me a very interesting new perspective and gives me a lot of new insights into this area that otherwise I would just glance over.
And the same for me as well, but in some ways the opposite, which is, how do these theoretical, these policy, these legal concepts fit in with the actual operational technology or the specific technology that we're discussing, which is where Pete has a lot of insight that I don't have. And so I really enjoy that. You did mention this thing we've read a bunch of times. So I'm just going to ask you a little question about that.
Yeah.
How many copies of the CRA do you have in your possession? How many printed copies of the CRA do you currently own, and how many of them are annotated?
That's a great question. So I can tell you that I'm sitting at my desk as we're recording this, and around me are currently, within arm's length, are four printed editions of the CRA. One of them is open.
So we've been involved with this thing, because it is also worth noting that you cannot purchase a printed copy of the CRA. Yet I also own, I think, four, maybe five of them. Somehow we've just gathered them, but you can't go out online and be like, I'd like a copy of that law. At least not yet.
I didn't just gather them. So of the four on my desk, one of them I got as a gift from a mutual friend, and three of them are actually from my own print. So I print the CRA on A6 format, and I call it the pocket edition, and I give it out as merch.
So this is basically part of the pitch for working with Pete, is you can get a pocket copy of Cyber Resilience.
And it looks really cool.
To carry around with you and impress people at parties.
I feel a bit ashamed of saying this, but it's actually a true statement that I do not leave the house without the CRA on me. Maybe if I go jogging or something like that. Anyway.
So that's who we are. We're basically CRA obsessives. That's who we are. But what is the CRA?
Exactly.
That's probably what we should tell people, right?
Let's jump to that, because
we've just told it's very exciting. Yeah. But what is the Cyber Resilience Act? And why should anybody care about it?
So if I need to summarize the Cyber Resilience Act in one sentence, it's basically, it's a law that places cybersecurity requirements on all so-called products with digital elements that are sold in the EU after the end of next year.
Well, let's not say sold, let's say placed on the European market, because that itself is a point of discussion. But we won't get into it now. Sold is largely correct.
Sold is largely correct, yeah. I did say the one sentence summary. I think we can have an entire episode on the concept of placing on the market.
Or what is a product?
Or what is a product? I think that's more than one episode.
Yeah. So this is a complicated sort of wilderness of regulation that we're asking you to go on a journey with us through. Yeah. But let's just continue with the overview.
There was kind of a second sentence to that first sentence, and that is, so you will often hear this term, products with digital elements, because that's the term that's used in the law. Interestingly, the law does not really explain what it is. I don't think it's a defined term. Or do you know?
It's a defined term.
Is it the defined term?
Let's look at Article 3.
Yeah, so,
and see if there's a definition.
So what's happening right now?
It's not a well-defined term, we'll say.
What's happening right now is that I grabbed the printed copy of the CRA that was laying next to me, and I went to Article 3. And I actually, you're right, it is a defined term. And I'll read the definition for us.
So, it's not going to,
no,
the definition
it's not,
is not going to help us. That's the point.
So it says, products with digital elements means a software or hardware product and its remote data processing solutions, including software or hardware components being placed on the market separately. So let's, there's actually
just
a lot
hold
of...
on to that for a bit. Yeah. Just sit with that and decide what you as a listener think that means. Because, you know, and we'll might be right.
I think we should come back to this definition in a couple of minutes, because there's actually some interesting things to unpack there. When you look a little bit further into the law, you'll figure out that like what products with digital elements, what it really means is it's basically any product that has a data interface of some sort. So either because it's a hardware that's product.
Connectivity.
But you need to be careful with connectivity, because some people think that connectivity means IoT, but the definition is quite a bit broader than that, right? So if I have any device that you know that has a radio in it, so that talks Wi-Fi or Bluetooth, is obviously in scope, but also anything that has a USB port through which data is exchanged is also in scope. And also something that is not so clear from the term products, but products really means both hardware and software products. So if you have a software product, it's largely accepted that basically every meaningful piece of software will have some sort of data interface, because it will either be importing a file or it will be interacting with an operating system or something like that.
I would say, Pete, a way to simplify this is if you have a piece of technology, something you consider digital technology, the chance that it's not a product with digital elements under the meaning of the CRA is very small. Maybe we can spend a little time some other time trying to figure out what isn't a product.
That would be interesting, because there are some.
Because I've sat across from other rapporteurs and had this discussion, and it has not. We have not immediately jumped to a lot of, oh, that's the thing. So effectively, every piece of technology, software and hardware, and to some extent services, but that's its own discussion that we won't get into right now, are regulated under this law. Yep. And to me, that's one of the huge things about it. It is a product safety regulation. In the same way that the amount of insects you can have in your ground coffee is a food safety regulation, this tells you the amount of insects that you can have in your digital products. Not insects, maybe bugs. Is that a good metaphor?
Terrible metaphor. I think it's a terrible metaphor.
But it's in the same vein as kind of consumer safety, product safety, and placing software particularly, and the hardware as well. And hardware, of course, has always had safety regulations, so don't let it catch fire, that kind of thing. But this is also make sure it secures the data within it. It's not just don't use a plug that causes your IoT toaster to explode. It's don't let your IoT toaster be used as part of a DDoS network.
Yeah.
That's incredibly ambitious, right? This has not been done before. This is the thing to me that makes the CRA so fascinating to me.
So you mean it's never been done for software before, right?
It's never been done for software before.
Yeah.
And that I know of. Maybe there's small areas where you could say, oh, it's been done for software. Pete mentioned medical device directives and things like that. And it's absolutely true. There's software there. It's being regulated for safety and security. But in the past, European regulation, I think globally, regulation on software has largely been about something like the GDPR. How does your software service, how does the service that your software implements look after consumer data?
Mm.
It's not about how hard is it to break into your software and do unpleasant things? And this is huge. Again, the refrain that I think I'm adopting for the CRA is this incredibly ambitious law.
Yeah. And so one thing, because you mentioned before that this is basically a safety legislation. And what's interesting there is that, so the CRA is part of this thing called the NLF, the New Legislative Framework, which is the legal framework that the EU uses for all sorts of product safety legislation, and where most people listening will know this from is from the CE mark. Basically, the NLF is the legal framework that governs the CE mark. It sets out the rules for what the requirements are for products to be CE marked. And
in the end of, at the end of 2027, by the end of 2027, or starting at the end of 2027, all your software is going to have a CE mark on it.
Yeah, correct.
It's going to have to.
And
unless you want to get in trouble by selling that software.
And that what's really important there is that all of this regulation, it's not some sort of maximum bar that you need to meet. It's actually quite the opposite, because this regulation, it's a market entry requirement. So it basically says, if you're not doing at least this, you're not allowed to sell your product in the EU.
Or distribute it for commercial purposes.
Yeah.
And there are exceptions. There's, for example, open source is a fairly large exception to this that is worth talking about.
Yeah.
And of particular interest to me. But largely, it's exactly as Pete says. Europe is no longer just going to let you sell software that's not minimally secure.
Yeah, or hardware. Or, right? And this,
or hardware.
Maybe this is also...
August, by minimally secure, I think... Yeah, go on.
We kind of pulled the... Or talked about the contrast where you are coming more from the legal side and I'm coming from the technical side. Similarly, you are coming more from the software side, right? Specifically, you're quite involved with the open source software movement. I'm coming more from the embedded manufacturing side, so from manufacturers that create hardware products that typically also contain software then. And so that's also a way in which we both look at this piece of legislation from slightly different angles, just because when we're working with our clients, we are encountering different types of issues because we're looking at these different types of products.
For example, one of them is we're talking about the timelines for the CRA, and that's probably another topic that we should mm-hmm. cover really quickly, because why is it important? Why have we decided to do this podcast now? Why are we so excited about the CRA right now? It's because the CRA, which was adopted in 2024, it's been discussed since 2022, it comes into effect, at least partially, in September 2026, in a couple months. And then finally, all of the requirements come into effect at the end of 2027, yeah. Which if you're coming from the manufacturer of hardware, especially the manufacturer of hardware, software as well, that's not a lot of time. That is longer, I think, confirm this with me, that's longer than a lot of product development timelines. So if you're starting about thinking about a new product now, or you started thinking about developing a new product a couple of years ago even, you should probably be becoming CRA compliant as part of that process, because yep. it's going to be a lot harder to comply with this law after being, oh, we're all done. Oh, no, now we got to go back and figure out if we're CRA compliant, as opposed to starting from the beginning, baking in these requirements. They're not hard requirements, but it's always harder to fix something after it's
done. Maybe we can use this as a moment to take a little bit of a step back and talk about what actually are those requirements that are in the CRA, right? Because we've established like roughly what it is, but let's go into a little bit more detail.
Broadly. Yep. Let's not get too deep into the weeds, because we could.
Yep.
But so, broadly, yeah. So what do you see them as?
Yeah. To me, there's four big classes of requirements in there. The ones that get the most attention, which I think is not fully justified actually, are the product requirements. So there's this section of the CRA. If you're somewhat familiar with the CRA, you might know it as a Annex 1 Part 1, where there's basically a bunch of requirements that say when you build a product, you need to make sure that the confidentiality of the data on that product is protected. Or you have to make sure that that product implements appropriate access control measures. So that's really about the technical properties of the product.
It's focusing on the security, the cybersecurity of the product.
Yeah.
These are called the essential cybersecurity requirements.
Yeah, but this is only the first part, right? So these are, and I'm maybe you
yeah,
can hear
is,
it, I'm
going been, through my copy. Or maybe it's the third part. I mean, it happens later. That happens in 2027. Let's tell me the other three before I interrupt and run off.
Right. So what we talked about first are these essential cybersecurity requirements, as the law says, that are relating to the properties of products with digital elements. So it's really about things that you can see on the product. But then there's also a bunch of requirements on the development process and the documentation that you must create during the development of your product. So basically, even though it doesn't say it explicitly in the law, de facto, the CRA requires you to implement the so-called security development lifecycle. Sometimes people also call it the secure development lifecycle, which...
For design and development is, I believe, the term that you find in the essential requirements for it.
There's some discussion about that, actually, how you should interpret that. But basically...
Oh, I know. It's who knows what it means?
Yeah,
it's a catch-all, right?
Who knows
right.
what it means? That's another interesting topic for another episode, I think. But basically...
There's so many of these little cul-de-sacs or things that need to be worked out still, honestly. That's what these are. These are areas where the CRA still needs to be interpreted. And we might not know the answer till the courts get hold of it in 5-10 years, right?
But
that's one of the fascinating things about it being a legal document.
Yeah. But so basically what an SDL or a security development lifecycle, what that means is it's a set of process activities that you need to go through during product development that force you as a manufacturer to actually consider the security aspects of your product. So you need to think about, okay, like I have this product here from a security perspective, what could actually go wrong with it? How likely is it that that would go wrong? What would be the impact if that goes wrong? And then how risky is that overall? Can I accept that? Can I not accept that? Like, is that an acceptable or an unacceptable risk? And then you need to think, okay, how am I going to resolve these unacceptable cybersecurity risks in my product? And you need to go and build the product in such a way so that there's these measures to help you resolve that those security risks are in the product. And then you also need to test that the product actually behaves as you expected, so that those security mechanisms that you implemented, that they actually also work as expected. Right.
So, and then Pete, you're saying there's two parts here, and this is distinct from the essential cybersecurity requirements of what the security functions of the product are, because this is how you are going, as the manufacturer, are going to ensure that those security functions can be shown, that is documented and tested, assessed. This is the part that says how to assess the product, how to show off that you've complied.
Yes and no. So basically, this is the process that you're supposed to follow to discover what actually the relevant security measures for your product are, because in the CRA, everything is risk-based. And what that means is that the CRA does not give you specific security requirements for things that your product must comply with. That's also why before, when I was talking about, for example, authentication, I was not saying you must have this or this authentication. I was at least trying to be a bit more vague and say you need to use adequate authentication. And basically...
And this is something that partly comes out of the desire to cover so many different products.
Yeah, exactly. So,
but partly comes out of the desire to be a law that can last.
Yep.
And so even the standards, which are less formal, less necessary to the functioning of the CRA, try not to prescribe specific technological solutions,
but
mitigations.
But basically what the product requirements say is they say, okay, your product must have adequate access control, it must adequately protect the data that's stored on the product. And then these process requirements, so the security development lifecycle, that's actually the mechanism to which the manufacturer, they determine what that adequacy means. So what is adequate access control? What is adequate protection of the data?
Two more of those.
Yeah,
and I know there's two more sets of requirements. And I know one of them is vulnerability handling. What is that?
Let's stick with these process requirements for a second.
You want to stick with the product?
Yeah,
the product,
a little bit more. Right. Because basically, so
okay.
You need to do all of those things. So you need to go through those processes. But then you also need to document it as we both referred to before. And that's really important, because if you're a manufacturer, that documentation is how you can prove that you've actually gone through those steps. Because under the CRA, most of the so-called market enforcement, so where the government checks whether manufacturers actually comply with the requirements, does not happen before you put the product on the market. Instead, anyone can put a product on the market at any time. But then when you put a product on the market, then the so-called market surveillance authority, they might knock on your door at any time and say, like, hey, please show us that your product is compliant. And then you need to be able to demonstrate to the market surveillance authority that you went through these process steps to determine like what is an adequate level of security for your product.
And one of the things I think that's important about this, because we're digging into this a little bit, but when we talk about product documentation, this is not the document. This is not the booklet that comes to the consumer with the product.
No.
This is what is referred to in the CRA as technical documentation primarily. Yeah. And when we talk about documentation requirements, which what we're talking about, what we're talking about is very technical information.
Often also secret information.
That is secret that you as the manufacturer hold on to. And you might share that with people, particularly if you're selling components.
Yeah.
You might provide that to the person who's integrating that component into their product so they can more easily comply with the CRA. But this is not something that you just spread around. And I mentioned this because I know this is something that causes anxiety to manufacturers. They're like, I don't want to give away my trade secrets. And I don't blame them.
Yeah. And I can say that for maybe manufacturers that are already active in, say, the machinery space, they would be very familiar with this concept, but they would probably call it a technical construction file or TCF, which is just this information, this logbook or description of how you built the product that you keep as a manufacturer internally to be able to demonstrate your compliance to the authorities if they ask for it.
And would the sort of software equivalent be the documentation that you have, internal documentation within your code, the notes you put on your issues and your pull requests?
It's a very good question. And I think that's, again, a completely separate episode. But traditionally, for compliance, the way that this documentation gathering has happened is that when you create a product, the compliance department or whoever does the compliance, they go and gather all of this data and then they put it in one folder structure and then they archive it somewhere away because there's a legal requirement that you need to hold on to this data for at least 10 years. And at the moment, it's really this manual process of compiling all of that data. but it's...
What are the other two requirements here?
Yeah.
Because again, we could talk about this one forever.
I'll finish the thought and then we'll jump to the next one. So an open question is this traditional way of gathering compliance documentation, does that still work when you're talking about software development and this and these dynamic and systems where, you know, software is developed continuously, and it's not that you just at some point you finish your product design and then you sell it for 10 years. It's like you finish your product design and then the next day you have a new version of the software.
And this concept in general is one of the really ambitious things about the CRA, that it's taking a product or an industry that where individual products constantly change, constantly updated, and trying to apply fairly traditional product regulatory structures to it.
Yeah.
And that's a square peg round hole, but there's been a lot of hammering. Yeah. So it's fitting in a way, and that how it fits is a very interesting topic. But
Should we finally jump to the last two?
Yeah, let's finally jump. Okay. I'm talking about pegs
and
holes.
We talked about the product requirements, we talked about the process and the documentation requirements, and the third set of requirements, there are the support requirements and the vulnerability management requirements.
Is that third and fourth, or is that just
that's
third?
That's third. So I'm taking those together. So under the CRA, and this is the first time that this has been done, as a manufacturer, you are not just responsible for the compliance of your product when you first sell it, but you have to declare a so-called support period, which needs to be aligned with the time that the product is expected to be in use. And during that entire time, which is a time period that will be measured in years, right, I would expect to see numbers ranging anywhere between, say, 5 and 20 years or something, might be a bit more even. That's also another episode to talk about support periods and what is appropriate. But basically
And also we could start talking about the product liability directive there too, because that stacks on top of it and has got different liability rules. Oh, it's the wilderness gets more thorny and deeper.
But so the base concept is that as a manufacturer, you need to make sure that your product stays compliant while it is in use out there with your customers. And that really means that you cannot just sell the product and forget about it, but actually after you sold it, you need to keep monitoring your product for potential vulnerabilities. And if you figure out that there is a vulnerability in your product, then you actually need to take actions to bring the product back into compliance. So that can mean sending a software update out. It might also mean doing a recall of your product, although it's unclear in what situations that might happen, but the law says that recalls might be possible. Or in some cases, it might also mean if you cannot fix the problem with a software update, maybe it just means that you need to inform all of your users or all of your customers that they need to be careful with using the product in a certain way.
So Pete, is this a good time to mention that we're talking about manufacturers, but there are a few other categories, there are several other categories of economic actors within the CRA that frequently have these requirements and where it becomes more complicated.
Yep.
For example, if you're an importer of a product, which will not be CE stamped necessarily, you have duties under the CRA to make sure that foreign product is also compliant.
Yeah, correct.
Or if you are a component, you're buying components overseas, that's pretty common. Or you're using open source components, which don't have necessarily free open source, doesn't have to comply with the CRA. You're responsible for those as well, which becomes incredibly complex if you're talking about a 10-year life cycle for that product and making sure that those components or that imported product have those security fixes going forward.
Yep. Yeah. And it's also
and so it's very complex. This can be very complex.
It is very complex. And there's this typical dynamic with the CRA where, for example, the CRA says, you just mentioned it, that when you integrate a component into your own product, you as a manufacturer, you're responsible for ensuring that that component that you integrate is sufficiently secure for the use case that you're using it for. Right. So that component will not lead to your product being insecure. And this is one of these topics where the obligation sounds very straightforward, but actually implementing this can be very difficult because it's something that manufacturers, particularly in the software space, are just not used to doing. So it's a really big paradigm shift in how or where the responsibility lies in software development. And you often hear the statement, statements which I think can be summarized as people saying like, oh, but the commission or the EU cannot possibly be serious that we need to do. They cannot possibly really mean it. And almost always the answer is, well, actually, yes, they do mean it. And they do want you to go and do that. And for me, this...
They're very serious about that.
They're very serious about that.
that's everything. Every time I've talked to someone who works, is involved with the commission or involved with the government, they're very serious about that.
Yeah. And to me, the support period is one of those few areas where the consequences of the obligation as it is in the law are so far-reaching that that's one of the very few areas where I think, okay, maybe the governments are going to back down a bit in how strict they enforce this.
Or the courts might mitigate that as well. And I think this is, again, where the Product Liability Directive comes in.
Yeah.
Because the Product Liability Directive has its own timelines.
This is the third area of regulation, to put this a little bit into perspective for some of our listeners, right? So let's say that you're a company and you develop a product and you have a 5-year product development time, right? That's already 5 years that you're dealing with that product. Then that product might be on the market for, let's say, 20 years. And at the end of that 20-year time period, you will have already been dealing with that product for 25 years. Then let's say that this is a product that has a lifetime of 20 years, then that last product that you've sold, because the CRA always applies to individuals, so units of the product, that last product that you sold, you need to support for another 20 years, right? Which means that by the time that you as a manufacturer, that all of your obligations, your compliance obligations for that product have completed, from the initial development until the end of the last support period for your product, that could be a 45-year period. Right, which is enormous.
The people that worked on this product in the beginning will have retired.
Yeah, the technology might not even be. I mean, think of
the
like,
technology will have retired.
I mean, think of what kind of.
What were you doing 45 years ago? What was your computer like? Right.
Yeah, it's like, what was it? 1980. Like.
Yeah, you have your Apple II Plus.
Exactly.
Maybe?
So
maybe some green. Your.
It's
$15,000 equivalent home business computer from IBM.
Yeah. So
and probably not very secure either. It's going to be very hard to have those timelines.
It will be very interesting to see how that plays out. And this is also for manufacturers at the moment, this is kind of tricky for them to navigate because they also don't know how it will play out. And they need to also decide on how they're going to prepare for however this might play out. Right? Maybe it will be that they have to deal with this product for up to 45 years. Right? Maybe.
And there might be some ways around it as well, particularly with software products within the CRA.
Yeah.
But this is all stuff that we could talk about in detail.
Anyway, that was the third requirement. Right? So we've had product requirements, we had process and documentation requirements, and then now we had the support and vulnerability management requirements. And all of these requirements, they enter into effect for all the product units that are sold on or after the 11th of December 2027. So basically, if you want to sell a product in the EU on or after the 11th of December 2027, you need to do all of these things.
Yep.
The fourth...
You need to have assessed and prepared plans and have this documentation. Yeah.
The fourth set of requirements is special because it starts applying, I believe we mentioned this before, but it starts applying from the 11th of September this year. So in, what is that, in... 2.5 months?
Let's say 2.5 months.
In two and a half months.
Let's just say 2.5 months.
And these requirements, they apply not just to products that you sell from the date, but to all products, so products with digital elements that you have ever sold. And those are the so-called reporting requirements. And what they say is that if you as a manufacturer, you become aware of either a actively exploited vulnerability on a product that you have sold at any point in the past, or you have a severe incident which could affect the security of a product that you have sold in the past, then you are required by law to notify ENISA, so the European Cybersecurity Agency, and your local CSIRTs or your local
Cybersecurity response team?
Or computer, I think computer, I think computer security incident response team. So that's like...
Yes, that sounds right.
So that's a national body. So there's 27 of those in the EU. That's a national body that's responsible for coordinating all of the security or cybersecurity issues that occur in a country.
And the one thing I will say that's nice about this is that there's supposed to be a common platform where you can report to both of these at once. So hopefully that will make things a little easier. That's being implemented right now, last minute. We'll see how it works. And this reporting requirement isn't just, you know, it starts out with you just notify these groups of the incident or the known exploited vulnerability, but then it has follow-up reports as well. So it's not that simple of a requirement. I wouldn't say it's also that onerous.
No, I think it's something that's like when you look on LinkedIn these days, it's blown a bit out of proportion, because the key thing here is like, yes, it applies to all the products you've ever sold, but it only applies when you as a manufacturer become aware of such a thing happening. So what the
And I think if you look at the guidance, it's not just when it becomes known to you, it's there's fairly lenient rules about that.
But basically...
That are based on like GDPR notifications and other laws have already discussed this area.
But basically what it means, if you're a product manufacturer and you have a customer that calls you up and they say like, hey, my factory got hacked and I know that it is because it came through, you know, somebody exploited vulnerability in your product, then at that point you need to inform the INISA and your national CCERT of that happening.
Right away. Within 24 hours.
Correct.
But you don't need to tell them exactly all the details because you probably don't know them yet. And you just need to say, hey, something bad is happening. Is it hacking? Cats and dogs living together.
But what's not in this requirement what's not in the requirement that applies from September this year is the like two things. First of all, it doesn't require you to go and actively look for incidents. And second, if something happens, so if your product is exploited, you're not actually, there's no obligation yet to go and patch the product. Of course, if you're a reputable manufacturer, you should surely do so. But strictly speaking,
you want to keep selling the product.
Yes, and you want to, you know, keep your reputation. You should definitely help your customers and fix your product. But
then I think your follow-up reports in, what is it, the first one is like 72 hours or is it longer?
72 hours. But 72 hours 72, after
and then there's the, one in like, initial report.
Yeah. So it's 72 hours, but it's also 72 hours after becoming aware, which means that technically it's like 48 hours after the first message minimum.
You have to say what you think it is and if you've done any mitigation. And then there's a final report with 3 months, something like that.
Yeah. So this is interesting because if it's an actively exploited vulnerability, the final report is, I think it's 2 weeks after you made a patch available. But if you never make available a patch, then that never triggers. And so that's a little bit ambiguous.
Although I think one of the things here is that my suspicion, and this is just weird, crazy person speculation, crazy. This is not legal advice as well. Nothing I say is legal advice. But this is my personal speculation, is that not reporting efforts to mitigate known exploited vulnerabilities is going to be one of the things that may convince the MSA, the Market Surveillance Authority, that's the people that will potentially fine you for violating the CRA, to come take a look at your product.
Yeah, but
especially if you're reporting that it's a serious incident.
But that's only going to be relevant after the 11th of December, 2027. Right?
True.
Because also, so like... What I just said before is that you're from September this year, you don't have to go and look for those vulnerabilities and you don't have to resolve the problem if the problem is in your product. That sounds a bit absurd, but that's only absurd in the transition time, because the obligation to do both those things, so to go to actively look for those incidents or vulnerabilities, and on the other hand, also the obligation to patch, so to fix the situation, that's all coming in this obligation package that's starting at the end of 2027. And so in the transition period, it's a little bit absurd, but that's only going to be the case for 1.5 years, right? And then once the CRA is...
So would it, in your opinion, Pete, would it be reasonable to say that if you're a manufacturer who has a severe exploited vulnerability after the 11th of September, 2026, and you do your reporting, one, you should do that, because if you don't report it at all, then you're potentially at risk. And you don't fix it by December of 2027, that might be a concern. That might be someone that would trigger some oversight. Perhaps.
I guess it depends if you're still selling this product, yes or no, right?
Knowing what I know about security vulnerabilities, I feel like there's a good chance someone will be doing this.
Yeah, it's possible. But if let's say that this vulnerability only affects a product that you stopped selling 3 years ago, then you would technically still have an obligation to report about this actively exploited vulnerability. But because you're no longer selling that product, you will also no longer be placing any units of that product on the market after the end of 2027. So therefore, the other obligations would not apply to that old product, because that's a product that you sold in the past.
Right. There's obviously exceptions.
There are exceptions. And
whether your specific product or the product you're concerned about fits into those exceptions is part of the fun of complying with the CRA.
Yeah. I think,
and it's not a simple question ever.
Yeah.
Even
there's a significant amount of messiness in the transition of no CRA to CRA, and for products that you sold before, but that you're still issuing software updates for, or that you're still supporting in some way, it can become quite messy. And also, I would argue that the legal text there is actually not quite clear on what obligations you have.
No legal text is ever entirely clear when it first comes out. And so I think, Pete, we've talked quite a bit. We've covered the basics of the CRA and what it requires. Do you want to leave people with maybe a final thought for this episode on what they should take away from this, or what if you have one lesson for them? I think I have one.
Maybe. I can say that one thing that we haven't talked about yet, and which is actually a little bit atypical for consultants to not talk about, that's the penalty section, right? Because as with many of the new kind of high profile EU legislations or regulations, there are very high maximum penalties in the CRA. So basically, if you as a manufacturer, if you're violating the CRA, you can be fined up to 15 million euros or 2.5% of global group turnover, whichever is higher, right? Which is an enormous number, which many colleague consultants like to use to scare people into compliance or into compliance efforts. But yeah, when I hear this number, I'm always, and I think your view from the legal side will also be quite interesting on that. I'm always a bit skeptical of, I tend to warn customers to not be too scared of it, because the problem with this number is that it's so big that it can scare people into paralysis. Right? Now the CRA is a piece of legislation that puts a very large amount of responsibility onto the manufacturer. Like, as we discussed, this responsibility of determining what level of security is appropriate for your product. And I've seen manufacturers that are just unable or are so afraid of taking that responsibility because they're worried that if they get it wrong, they will be fined that 15 million euros.
Yeah, I think this is very similar to the takeaway I was going to say, because I think both of us have a perspective of this is not as scary as a lot of people make it out to be. Mm-hmm. The CRA is huge. It is ambitious. It is a lot of requirements. But I think for me, when we're talking about these penalties, if I remember correctly, there's actually discussion within the CRA itself. It might be in the recitals that these penalties are the maximums. And it is not the goal of the CRA to bankrupt people for messing up. That any penalty should be also appropriate to the, particularly for small, medium enterprises, which under EU laws can get pretty big. So there's that potential mitigation in there that the courts are supposed to, I think, follow, that I think is in the recitals. But there's also the question of enforcement, right? And when you look at any of these European technology laws, they have these huge fines associated with them potentially. But they also cover so many products in this case that it's not like there are people out there that can check every manufacturer. And there's certainly not going to be a process for that and making it streamlined and efficient for several years, for many mm-hmm. years. I assume that a lot of these issues are going to be tested in the courts, especially if they go out for a $15 million fine. Or 15 million euro fine, excuse me, mm-hmm. that is probably going to be targeted at a large hyperscaler or large industry.
Mm.
And that'll be contested.
Yeah. And also, so
who knows what will come out of that contest?
So I find it a bit, I find it a bit risky to rely on the fact that nobody is going to look at your product, because that you cannot know.
Oh, I'm not saying you shouldn't rely on that. I'm not saying you should rely on that at all.
Yeah.
The thing I would follow that up with is, I think for manufacturers, A consideration should always be how much risk you're actually taking, how much risk you are comfortable with, and how much risk you can mitigate easily,
mm.
right? So I wouldn't say just YOLO, throw up your hands, it's the CRA, whatever, it's never going to happen, because it is going to happen and people are going to be fined.
Mm-hmm.
I would say do your best to comply, and maybe don't stress as much about the exact form of that compliance, or if you've gotten everything 100% right at this point, because in the end, there's going to be people. We know there's going to be people who are doing a lot worse job than you if you've taken some time to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're listening to this podcast, you're probably already thinking about it.
Yeah. And you know, I'd like to add to that that when you read the CRA, and like one of the first recitals, which is, we used the word already before, but the recitals are basically, it's a list of considerations that comes before the law that explains what the thinking was of the lawmakers while they were writing the law. And then one of the first recitals says literally, you know, that one of the main aims of the regulation is to make sure that manufacturers take cybersecurity seriously. And it also, there's also some wording on there, like it says the goal is not to make sure that products are perfectly secure. Actually, it says that the aim is to make sure that products are placed on the market with fewer vulnerabilities and that manufacturers take security seriously throughout the product's lifecycle. And what my takeaway is from the conversations that I've had with various market surveillance authorities already. So those are the authorities that check whether your product is compliant, and that are also the authorities that would issue the fines. They all understand that that is what they have to check for. And so they don't have to check for whether manufacturers made mistakes while they were doing their CRA compliance, you know, whether they accidentally forgot something and therefore the product stayed vulnerable, or whether they, you know, maybe just misjudged a certain risk and therefore a mitigation measure that's in the product is not adequate. But what they really want to look for is, did they do an honest effort, and did they take the cybersecurity topic serious? And as long as you can convince the market surveillance authority that the answer to both of those two questions is yes, I don't expect that any meaningful fines will be given to those kind of companies.
There's also an opportunity, I believe under the CRA, there's an opportunity for, say, instead of issuing a fine, issuing a notice to fix things or a warning or things like that. I believe that is one of the things they can do. And I expect to see a lot of those, especially in the first few years.
Yeah, exactly. And I think there also is, when you have a market surveillance authority that approaches you because they think your product might be non-compliant, I expect that initially those are almost always going to be friendly conversations. And if you engage with them and you show to them that you take this topic seriously and that you want to make your product secure, I think in most cases, or in almost all cases, there will be a very reasonable agreement found between the market surveillance authority and the manufacturer. If, however, the market surveillance authority sees that you're not cooperative, right, and that you maybe actively try to avoid some of the CRA requirements, I think then you're in for a completely different ballgame, because then you could potentially get fines. But also, like, a lot of people forget this, because the CRA is a market entry or market access requirement or regulation, it means that if it's determined that your product is non-compliant, you might no longer be able to sell that product on the European market until you've resolved that issue, right? Which means that, you know, let's say that it's an issue that takes you 3 months to fix, because then you also need to convince the market surveillance authority that you actually fixed it or whatever, then that might be 3 months or quite easily longer, right? Like I think fixing a product can quite easily take longer than that amount of time during which you cannot sell your product and you have all that lost revenue. And that revenue is at that point is probably going to one of your competitors and your customers might be staying there afterwards. And then the economic impact of that on your company is in many cases probably going to be a lot bigger than the impact of a fine that you might get.
And it'd be reputation as well.
Yeah.
It could potentially be ruinous. Rather than emphasize the negatives, I think to put some words in Pete's mouth perhaps, I think both of us want to emphasize again that we consider the CRA fundamentally reasonable and that it's something that as a manufacturer or as an importer or any of these other categories, big open source project, commercial open source project, you can comply with. Mm-hmm. And in complying with it, you'll probably have a better product.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
In the long run. And that's not a bad thing. It may cost some money to comply with it, but it may save you some money as well.
And all of your competitors need to do the same thing.
Exactly. It can, having good security can itself be a marketing win as well. So,
okay, good. With that, I think that's a wrap for this first episode.
Yeah, we've covered the basics here. Thank you for listening to us, and we'll have more insight, more CRA talk, more of an ode to resilience.
Yeah, exactly.
In the future.
We don't know when yet, but soon.
Soon. All right.
Bye, everyone. Thanks for listening.
Bye, Pete. Talk to you soon.